This time, there was a slight difference in the wording of the prophecy from the one they had heard before, and all of them pondered it silently as the Amlimo fell forward onto her face and flopped limply as a boneless jellyfish. Slowly, all movement of the albino's body ceased, and she lay like death. Gandang made as if to rise, but Tanasi hissed a warning, and he arrested the movement, and they waited. The only sound in the cavern was the click and rustle of the fire, and the flirt of bat's wings high against the domed roof. Then another convulsion ran down the Amlimo's back, and her spine arched, her hideous face lifted, but this time her voice was childlike and sweet, and she spoke in the Matabili language for all of them to understand. "When the hornless cattle are eaten up by the great cross, let the storm begin." Her head sagged forward, and the child covered her with a caross of fluffy jackal furs.
"It is over," said Tanasi. "There will be no more."
Thankfully, the four indunas rose and crept back along the gloomy pathway through the catacombs. But as they saw the glimmer of sunlight through the entrance ahead, so their steps quickened until they burst out in the valley with such indecent and undignified haste that they avoided each other's eyes. That night, sitting in the open-sided setengi on the floor of the valley, Somabula repeated the prophecies of the Amlimo to the assembled indunas. They nodded over the first two familiar riddles. As they had done 100 times before, they delved inconclusively for the meaning, and then agreed, "We will find the meaning when the time is appointed. It is always the way." Then Somabula went on to relate the third prophecy of the Amlimo, the new and unfamiliar riddle. "When the hornless cattle are eaten up by the great cross." The indunas took snuff and passed the beer pots from hand to hand as they talked and argued the hidden meaning. And only when they had all spoken did Somabula look beyond them to where Tanasi sat holding the child under her leather cloak to protect him from the night chill.
"What is the true meaning, woman?" he asked.
"Not even the Amlimo herself knows that," Tanasi replied. "But when our ancestors first saw the white men riding up from the south, they believed that their mounts were hornless cattle."
"Horses?" Gandang asked thoughtfully. "It may be so," Tanasi agreed. "Yet a single word of the Amlimo may have as many meanings as there are crocodiles in the Limpopo River."
"What is the cross? The great cross of the prophecy?" Batso asked.
"The cross is the sign of the white man's three-headed god," Gandang answered. "My senior wife Juba, the little dove, wears that sign about her neck, given to her by the missionary at Kami, where she poured water on her head."
"Is it possible that the white man's god would eat up the white man's horses?" doubted Babian. "Surely he is their protector, not their destroyer."
And the discussion passed from elder to elder, while the watching fire burned low, and over the valley the vast shining firmament of the heavens turned with weighty dignity. To the south of the valley, amongst the other heavenly bodies, burned a group of four great white stars that the Matabili called the Sons of Manatasi. They told how Manatasi, that terrible queen, had birth-strangled her offspring with her own hands, so that none of them might ever challenge her monarchy. According to the legend, the souls of the little ones had ascended to shine on high, eternal witness to the cruelty of their dam. Not one of the indunas knew that the name by which the white men knew these same stars was the Southern Cross. Ralph Ballantyne was wrong when he predicted to Harry Mellow that by the time they returned to the base camp, Mr. Rhodes and his entourage would have moved on to Bulawayo. For as they rode in through the gates of the stockade, he saw the magnificent mule coach still parked where he'd last seen it, and beside it were a dozen other decrepit and travel-worn vehicles, cape carts and surreys, even a bicycle with worn tyres replaced by strips of buffalo hide. "Mr. Rhodes has set up court here," Cathy explained furiously, as soon as she and Ralph were alone in the bath tent. "I've made the camp too comfortable by half, and he's taken it over from me."
"As he does everything else," remarked Ralph philosophically, as he stripped off his stinking shirt and flung it into the far corner. I've slept in that for 5 nights, by God. The laundry boy will have to beat it to death with a club before he gets it into the tub.
Ralph, you aren't taking me seriously. Kathy stamped her foot in frustration. This is my home, the only home I have. And now do you know what? Do you know what Mr. Rhodes has told me?
Have you got any more soap? Ralph demanded as he hopped on one leg to free his breeches. One bar will not be enough.
He said, Jordan will be in charge of the kitchens while we are here, Mrs. Ballantyne. He knows my tastes. But what do you think of that?
Jordan is a damn fine cook.
Ralph lowered himself gingerly into the bath and grunted as his naked buttocks touched the nearly boiling surface.
I have been forbidden my own kitchen.
Get in, Ralph ordered.
And she broke off and stared at him incredulously.
What did you say?
She demanded. But in reply, he seized her ankle and toppled Kathy, shrieking her protests on top of himself. Steaming water and suds splattered the canvas walls of the tent, and when he released her at last, she was sodden to the waist.
Your dress is soaked, he pointed out complacently. Now you have no choice. Take it off.
Naked, she sat with her back to him in the galvanized bath, with her knees drawn up under her chin, and her damp hair piled on top of her head. But still she continued her protest.
Even Louise could bear the man's arrogance and misogyny no longer. She made your father take her back to King's Lynn, so now I have to bear him on my own.
You always were a brave girl, Ralph told her, and ran the soapy flannel caressingly down her smooth back.
And now the word's gone out to every deadbeat and drifter in Matabele Land that he's here, and they're riding in from every direction for the free whisky.
Mr. Rhodes is a generous man, Ralph agreed, and tenderly slid the soapy flannel over her shoulder and down the front.
It's your whisky, said Kathy,
and caught his wrist before the flannel could reach its obvious destination.
The man has an infernal nerve.
For the first time, Ralph showed some emotion.
We'll have to get rid of him. That whisky is worth £10 a bottle in Bulawayo.
Ralph managed to slip the flannel a little further south.
Ralph, that tickles,
Kathy wriggled.
When are your twin sisters arriving? He ignored her protest.
They sent a runner ahead. They should be here before nightfall. Ralph, give me that flannel immediately.
We'll see how steely Mr. Rhodes' nerves really are.
Ralph, I can do that myself, thank you kindly. Give me the flannel.
And we will also see how sharp Harry Mellow's reflexes are.
Ralph, are you crazy? We're in the bath.
We will take care of both of them with one stroke.
Ralph, you can't, not in the bath.
We will have Jordan out of your kitchen, Harry Mellow, overseer of the Harkness Mine, and Mr. Rhodes on his way to Bulawayo, an hour after those two arrive.
Ralph, darling, do stop talking. I can't concentrate on two things at once,
Kathy murmured. The tableau at the trestle table in the dining tent seemed unaltered since Ralph had last seen it, rather like one of the productions at Madame Tussaud's waxworks. Mr. Rhodes even wore the same clothing as he dominated the tent with his expansive charisma. Only the bit players seated in the position of petitioners facing the long table had changed. These were a motley bunch of out-of-luck prospectors, concession-seekers, and impecunious promoters of ambitious ventures who had been attracted by Mr. Rhodes's reputation and millions, like jackal and hyena to the lion's kill. It was the mode in Matabele Land to display one's individuality by adopting eccentric headgear, and the selection which faced Mr. Rhodes across the table included a Scottish bonnet with an eagle feather pinned to the brim by a yellow cairngorm, a tall brushed beaver girt with a green St. Patrick's ribbon, and a magnificent embroidered Mexican sombrero, the owner of which was relating a meandering tale of woe, which Mr. Rhodes cut short. He did not enjoy listening as much as he did talking.
"So, you've had enough of Africa, have you? But you haven't the passage money,"
he asked brusquely.
"That's it exactly, Mr. Rhodes. You see, my old mother..."
"Jordan, give the fellow a chitty to see him home and charge it to me personally."
He waved away the man's thanks and looked up as Ralph came into the tent.
"Harry tells me your trip was a great success. He panned your crushings from the Harkness Reef at 30 ounces a ton. That's 30 times richer than the best banquet reef of the Witwatersrand. I think we should open a bottle of champagne. Jordan, don't we have a few bottles of Pommery 87 left?"
At least I'm not providing the champagne as well as the whiskey, Ralph thought cynically, as he lifted his glass to the toast. The Harkness mine, he joined the dutiful chorus, and the moment he had drunk, he turned on Dr. Leander Starr Jamieson. What is this about the mining laws? He demanded. Harry tells me you're adopting the American mining code. Do you have any objection? Jamieson flushed, and his sandy moustache bristled. That code was drawn up by lawyers to keep themselves in fat fees in perpetuity. The new Witwatersrand laws are simpler and a million times more workable. By God, isn't it enough that your company royalty will rob us of 50% of our profits? As Ralph said it, it dawned upon him that the American mining code would be a smokescreen behind which the artful Rhodes could manoeuvre at will. Remember, young Ballantyne, Jamieson stroked his moustache and blinked piously, remember who the country belongs to. Remember who paid the costs of the occupation of Mashonaland and who financed the Matabele War. Government by a commercial company. Despite himself, Ralph felt his anger rising again, and he clenched his hands on the table in front of him. A company that owns the police force and the courts, and if I have a dispute with your company, who will decide it? Surely not the BSA company's own magistrate.
There are precedents,
Mr. Rhodes's tone was reasonable and placatory, but his eyes were not.
The British East India Company?
And Ralph's reply crackled. The British government eventually had to take India away from those pirates, Clive, Hastings, and that ilk, for corruption and oppression of the natives. The Sepoy Rising was the logical outcome of their administration.
Mr. Ballantyne,
Mr. Rhodes's voice always went shrill when he was excited or angry,
I am going to ask you to withdraw those remarks. They are historically inaccurate and by implication insulting.
I withdraw unreservedly. Ralph was angry with himself now. He was usually much too cool-headed to allow himself to be provoked. There was no possible profit to be gained from a head-on collision with Cecil John Rhodes. His smile was easy and friendly as he went on. I am sure we will have no need of the services of a company magistrate.
Mr. Rhodes answered his smile with the same ease, but there was a steely blue flicker in his eyes as he raised his glass.
To a deep mine and a deeper relationship, he said,
and only one other person in the tent recognized it as a challenge. Jordan moved restlessly in his camp chair at the back of the tent. He knew these two men so well, loved them both so dearly. Ralph, his brother, had been with him through all that lonely and tempestuous childhood, his protector and his comfort in the bad times, and his joyous friend through the good. Looking at his brother now and comparing Ralph to himself, it seemed impossible that two brothers could be so different. Where Jordan was blonde and slim and graceful, Ralph was dark and muscled and powerful. Where Jordan was gentle and self-effacing, Ralph was hard and bold, and as hawk-fierce as his Matabele praise name implied. Instinctively, Jordan looked from him to the big burly figure facing him across the camp table. Here, Jordan's feelings went beyond love itself to a kind of religious fervour. He did not really see the physical changes that a few short years had wrought in this godhead of his existence. The thickening of Mr. Rhodes's already bulky body, the bloating and coarsening of features already mottled with cyanosis caused by the labouring of the damaged heart. The reddish-blonde curls receding swiftly now, and slashed with grey at the temples. The way a loving woman places little store on the appearance of the man she has chosen as her own. So Jordan saw far beyond the marks of suffering and sickness, and the racing years. He saw to the steely core of the man, the ultimate source of his immense power and brooding presence. Jordan wanted to cry out to his beloved brother, to run to him and physically restrain him from the folly of turning this giant of a soul into an enemy. He had seen other men do just that, and be ruthlessly crushed. Then, with a sickening slide in the pit of his stomach, he knew which side he would cast his lot if that dreaded confrontation ever forced a choice upon him. He was Mr. Rhodes's man, beyond brotherly ties and family loyalties. To the very end of life itself, he was Mr. Rhodes's man. He sought desperately for some plausible excuse to break the tension between the two most important persons in his life, but relief came from beyond the stockade, in the delighted cries of the servants, the hysterical barking of the camp dogs, the crunch of cartwheels, and the excited shrieks of more than one woman. Jordan was the only one watching Ralph's face, so he caught the sly and smug expression as his brother rose.
"It seems we have more visitors," Ralph said,
and the twins came into the inner stockade. Victoria came first, as Ralph had expected that she would. She came on long, shapely legs, outlined beneath the whirl and boil of her thin cotton skirts, barefoot, in defiance of all ladylike pretensions, carrying her shoes in one hand, and Jonathan riding on her hip. The child was squeaking like a warthog piglet that had lost its teat.
"Vicky, Vicky, did you bring me anything?"
"A kiss on the cheek and a slap on the behind," Vicky laughed and hugged him.